Chapter 10 Isaac Bell spotted John Scully's red handkerchief tied to a hedge. He swung the locomobile into the narrow road it marked, eased up on the accelerator pedal for the first time since he left Weehawken, and closed the cutout, which quieted the thunderous exhaust to a hollow mutter. He steered up a steep hill and drove a mile through fallow farm fields that awaited spring planting. The resourceful Scully had procured a milk can collection truck somewhere, exactly the sort of vehicle that would not look out of place on New Jersey's farm roads. Bell eased quietly alongside it so the locomobile could not be seen from the road. Then he heaved his golf bag off the passenger seat and carried it to the hill crest where the Van Dorn detective lay flat on brown grass. The laconic loner was a short, round man with a moon face who could pass for a trusted colleague of preachers, shopkeepers, safecrackers, or murderers. 30 pounds of fat disguised slabs of rock-hard muscle, and his diffident smile concealed a mind quicker than a bear trap. He was training field glasses on a house down the hill. Smoke rose from the kitchen chimney. A big Marmon touring car was parked outside, a powerful machine covered in mud and dust. "What's in the bag?" Scully greeted Bell. "Couple of 5 irons," Bell grinned, removing a pair of humpback 12-gauge Browning Auto 5 shotguns. "How many in the house?"
"All 3.
"Anyone living there?" "No smoke before they drove up." Bell nodded, satisfied that no innocents would be caught in a crossfire. Scully passed him the field glasses. He studied the house and the automobile. "Is that the Marmon they stole in Ohio?"
"Could be another. They're partial to Marmons."
"How'd you get a line on them?"
"Played your hunch about their first job. Their real name is Williard, and if me and you was half as smart as we think we are, we'd have tumbled to it a month ago."
"Can't argue with that," Bell admitted. "Why don't we start things off by putting their auto out of action?"
"We'll never hit it from here with these scatterguns."
Bell pulled from the golf bag an ancient 50-caliber Sharps Buffalo gun. John Scully's eyes gleamed like ball bearings.
"Where'd you get the cannon?"
"Our Knickerbocker house dick separated it from a Pawnee Bill Wild West show cowboy who got drunk in Times Square." Bell levered open the breech, loaded a black powder cartridge, and aimed the heavy rifle at the Marmon.
"Try not to set it on fire," Scully cautioned. "It's full of their loot.
I'll just make it hard to start."
"Hold it. What's that coming?"
A 6-cylinder K Ford was bouncing up the lane that led to the farmhouse. It had a searchlight mounted on the radiator.
"Hell's bells," said Scully.
"That's Cousin Constable." 2 men with sheriff stars on their coats climbed out of the Ford carrying baskets. Scully studied them through the glasses.
"Bringing them supper. 2 more makes 5.
"Got room in your milk truck?"
"If we stack 'em close."
"What do you say we give them time to get distracted filling their bellies?"
"It's a plan," said Scully, continuing to observe the house.
Bell watched the lane to the house and turned around repeatedly to be sure that no more relatives came up the back road he had taken. He was wondering where Dorothy Langner got the money to buy her father a piano when Bell remembered that she had given it to him only recently. Scully got uncharacteristically talkative.
"You know, Isaac," he said, gesturing toward the farmhouse below and the 2 automobiles, "for jobs like this, wouldn't it be nice if somebody invented a machine gun light enough to tote around with you?"
"A sub-machine gun?"
"Exactly, a sub-machine gun. But how would you lug all that water to cool the barrel?"
"You wouldn't have to if it fired pistol ammunition." Scully nodded thoughtfully.
"A drum magazine would keep it compact."
"Shall we start the show?" Bell asked, hefting the Sharps. Both detectives glanced at the woods near the house where the Fry boys would run when Bell disabled their autos.
"Let me flank 'em first," said Scully.
Putting words to action, he waddled down the hill, looking, Bell thought, like a bricklayer hurrying to work. He waved when he was in place.
Bell braced his elbows on the crest, thumbed the hammer to full cock, and sighted the sharps on the Marmon's motor cowling. He gently squeezed the trigger. The heavy slug rocked the Marmon on its tires. The rifle's report echoed like artillery, and a cloud of black smoke spewed from the muzzle and tumbled down the hill. Bell reloaded and fired again. Again the Marmon jumped, and a front tire went flat. He turned his attention to the police car. Wide-eyed constables boiled out of the house waving pistols. The bank robbers stayed inside. Rifle barrels poked from the window. A hail of lever-action Winchester fire stormed at the black powder smoke billowing from Isaac Bell's sharps. Bell ignored the lead howling past his head, methodically reloaded the single-shot sharps, and shot the Ford's motor cowling. Steam spurted from the hot radiator. Now their quarry was on foot. All three bank robbers darted from the house, rifles blazing. Bell reloaded and fired, reloaded and fired. A long gun went flying and the man staggered, clutching his arm. Another turned and ran toward the woods. Rapid fire bellowed from Scully's 12-gauge autoload and caused him to change his mind. He skidded to a stop, looked around frantically, and flung his weapon down and threw his hands in the air. The constables, gripping pistols, froze. Bell stood up, aiming the sharps through the black smoke. Scully sauntered from the woods, pointing his shotgun. "Mine's a 12-gauge autoload," Scully called conversationally. "Fellow up the hill's got a sharps rifle. About time you boys got smart." The constables dropped their pistols. The third Fry boy levered a fresh cartridge into his Winchester's chamber and took deliberate aim. Bell found him in his sights, but Scully fired first, tipping the barrel of his shotgun high to increase the range. The slugs spread wide at that distance. Most tore past the bank robber. Two that did not peppered his shoulder. Neither shot man was mortally wounded. Bell made sure that they would not bleed to death and handcuffed them with the others in Scully's milk truck. They started down the hill, Scully driving the truck, Bell in his locomobile bringing up the rear. Just as they reached the Cranberry Turnpike, Mike and Eddie, the Van Dorns assigned to help Scully, appeared in an Oldsmobile, and the caravan headed for Trenton to turn the bank robbers and the crooked cops over to the state's attorney. 2 hours later, nearing Trenton, Bell saw a road sign that jogged his photographic memory. The sign was a stack of town and road names lettered on white arrows that pointed south. The Hamilton Turnpike, the Bordentown Road, the Burlington Pike, and the Westfield Turnpike to Camden. Arthur Langner had written appointments on a wall calendar. 2 days before he died, he had met with Alistair MacDonald, the turbine propulsion specialist who had been contracted by the Navy's Steam Engineering Bureau. MacDonald's factory was in Camden. Her father loved his guns, Dorothy Langner had pleaded. As Farley Kent loved his hulls, as Alistair MacDonald his turbines. A wizard, she had called MacDonald, meaning he was her father's equal. Bell wondered what else the two men had in common. He squeezed the locomobile's horn bulb. The Oldsmobile and milk truck skidded to a dusty halt. "There's a fellow I ought to see in Camden," Bell told Scully. "Need a hand?" "Yes. Soon as you turn this bunch in, could you get to the Brooklyn Navy Yard? There's a naval architect in the drawing loft named Farley Kent. See if he's on the up and up." Bell turned the locomobile south. "On Camden's supplies, the world relies," a billboard greeted Isaac Bell as he entered the industrial city, which occupied the eastern shore of the Delaware River across from Philadelphia. He passed factories that made everything from cigars to patent drugs to linoleum and terracotta and soup. But it was the shipyard that dominated. The incongruously named New York Shipbuilding Company lined the Delaware and Newton Creek with modern covered ways and gigantic gantries thrusting at the smoky sky. Across the river sprawled Cramp Shipbuilders and the Philadelphia Navy Yard. Evening was falling before Bell found the McDonald Marine Steam Turbine Company inland from the riverfront in a warren of smaller factories that supplied the shipyard with specialty items. He parked the locomobile at the gate and asked to see Alistair McDonald. McDonald was not in. A friendly clerk said, "You'll find the professor down in Gloucester City, just a few blocks from here." "Why do you call him the professor?" "Because he's so smart. He was apprenticed to the inventor of the naval turbine, Charles Parsons, who revolutionized high-speed ship propulsion. By the time the professor emigrated to America, he knew more about turbines than Parsons himself." "Where in Gloucester City?"
"Del Rossi's dance hall. Not that he's dancing. It's more saloon than dance hall, if you know what I mean."
"I've encountered similar establishments out west," Bell said dryly. "Cut over to King Street. Can't miss it." Gloucester City was just down the river from Camden, the two cities blending seamlessly. King Street was near the water. Saloons, quick and dirties, and boarding houses hosted working men from the shipyards and the bustling river port. Del Rossi's was as unmissable as McDonald's clerk had promised, boasting a false front mocked up to look like a proscenium arch in a Broadway theater. Inside was bedlam, with the loudest piano Bell had ever heard, women shrieking with laughter, perspiring bartenders knocking the necks off bottles to pour faster, exhausted bouncers, and wall-to-wall sailors and shipyard hands. 500 men at least, determined to win the race to get drunk. Bell studied the room over a sea of flushed faces under clouds of blue smoke. The only occupants of the saloon not in shirt sleeves were himself in his white suit, a handsome silver-haired gent in a red frock coat whom he guessed was the proprietor, and a trio of dandified gangsters tricked out in brown derbies, purple shirts, bright waistcoats, and striped ties. Bell couldn't see their shoes, but suspected they were yellow. He plowed through broad shoulders toward the frock coat. "Mr. Del Rossi!" he shouted over the din, extending his hand.
"Good evening, sir. Call me Angelo."
"Isaac." They shook hands. Del Rossi's were soft, but bore the long-heeled burns and cuts of shipwork in his youth.
"Busy night." "God bless our new Navy. It's like this every night. New York ship launches the Michigan next month and just laid the keel for a 28-knot destroyer. Across the river, the Philadelphia Navy Yard is building a new dry dock. Cramp launches South Carolina come summer. Plus, they've already nailed a contract for 600 700-ton destroyers. Six. Count 'em. Six.
What can I do for you, sir?"
"I'm looking for a fellow named Alistair McDonald."
Del Rossi frowned.
"The professor?"
"Follow the sound of fists cracking jaws," he answered with a nod toward the farthest corner from the door.
"Excuse me. I better get over there before someone floors him."
"That's not likely," said Del Rossi. "He was heavyweight champ of the Royal Navy."
Bell sized McDonald up as he worked his way across the room, and he took an immediate shine to the big Scotsman. He looked to be in his 40s, tall, with an open countenance and muscles that rippled under a shirt soaked with perspiration. He had several boxing scars over his eyebrows, but not a mark on the rest of his face, Bell noticed, and enormous hands with splayed-out knuckles. He cupped a glass in one, a whiskey bottle in the other, and as Bell drew close, he filled the glass and stood the bottle on the bar behind him, his eyes fixed on the crowd. It parted suddenly, explosively, and a 300-pound bruiser lumbered at McDonald with murder in his eye. McDonald tracked him with a wry smile, as if they were both in on a good joke. He took a swig from his glass and then, without appearing to rush, closed his empty hand into an enormous fist and landed a punch almost too fast for Bell to see. The bruiser collapsed to the sawdust-strewn floor. McDonald looked down at him amiably. He had a thick Scots accent.
"Jake, me friend, you are a perfectly fine laddie till the drink riles your noggin."
Of the group around him, he asked, "Will someone see Jake home?" Jake's friends carried him out. Bell introduced himself to Alistair MacDonald, who, he surmised, was drunker than he looked.
"Do I know you, laddie?"
"Isaac Bell," he repeated. "Dorothy Langner told me that you were a particular friend of her father."
"That I was. Poor Artie. When they made the gunner, they broke the mold. Have a drink."
He called for a glass, filled it to the brim, and passed it to Bell with the Scottish toast,
"Slange."
"Slangeva," said Bell, and he threw back the fiery liquor in the same manner as MacDonald.
"How is the lass bearing up?"
"Dorothy is clinging to the hope that her father neither killed himself nor took a bribe."
"I don't know about killing himself. Mountains shade dark glens. But I do know this. The gunner would have shoved his hand in a punch press before he'd reach for a bribe."
"Did you work closely together?"
"Let's just say we admired each other."
"I imagine you shared similar goals."
"We both love dreadnoughts, if that's what you mean. Love 'em or hate 'em, the dreadnought battleship is the marvel of our age."
Bell noticed that, drunk or not, MacDonald was dodging his questions artfully. He backtracked, saying, "I imagine you must be following the progress of the Great White Fleet with keen interest." Alistair snorted scoffingly.
"Victory at sea goes to ordnance, armor, and speed. You've got to shoot farther than the enemy, survive more punishment, and steam faster. By those standards, the Great White Fleet is hopelessly out of date."
He splashed more liquor in Bell's glass and refilled his own. "England's HMS Dreadnought and the German Dreadnought copies have longer range, stronger armor, and dazzling speed. Our fleet, which is simply the old Atlantic squadron tarted up, is a flock of pre-dreadnought battleships."
"What's the difference?"
"A pre-dreadnought battleship is like a middleweight fighter who learned to box in college. He has no business in the prize ring with heavyweight Jack Johnson."
MacDonald grinned challengingly at Bell, whom he outweighed by 40 pounds. "Unless he did graduate studies on Chicago's West Side," Bell challenged him back.
"And put on a few pounds of muscle," MacDonald acknowledged approvingly.
Impossible as it seemed, the piano suddenly got louder. Someone banged on a drum. The crowd made way for Angelo Del Rossi to mount a low stage opposite the bar. He drew from his frock coat a conductor's baton. Waiters and bouncers put down trays and blackjacks and picked up banjos, guitars, and accordions. Waitresses jumped onto the stage and cast off their aprons, revealing skirts so short that police in any city with more than one church would raid the joint. Del Rossi raised his baton. The musicians banged out George M. Cohan's "Come On Down," and the ladies danced what appeared to Bell to be an excellent imitation of the Paris Can-Can.
"You were saying," he shouted.
"I was.
About the dreadnoughts that you and the gunner..."
"Take the Michigan. When she's finally commissioned, our newest battleship will have the best gun arrangement in the world. All big guns on superimposed turrets. But tissue-thin armor and rattle-trap piston engines doom her to be a semi-dreadnought at best. Target practice for German and English dreadnoughts."
MacDonald drained his glass.
"All the more terrible that the Bureau of Ordnance lost a great gun builder in Artie Langner. The technical bureaus hate change. Artie forced change. Don't get me started on this, laddie. It's been an awful month for America's battleships."
"Beyond the death of Artie Langner?" Bell prompted.
"The gunner was only the first to die. 1 week later, we lost Chad Gordon, our top armorer at Bethlehem Ironworks. Horrible accident. 6 lads roasted alive. Chad and all his hands. Then last week, that damn fool Grover Lakewood fell off the hill. The cleverest fire control expert in the business, and a hell of a fine young man. What a future he'd have given us. Gone in a stupid climbing accident."
"Hold on," said Bell. "Are you telling me that 3 engineers specializing in dreadnought battleships have all died in the last month?"
Sounds like a jinx, doesn't it?
MacDonald's big hand passed over his chest in the sign of the cross.
I would never say our dreadnoughts are jinxed. But for the sake of the United States Navy, I hope to bloody hell Farley Kent and Ron Wielder aren't next.
Hulls at the Brooklyn Navy Yard, said Bell. Torpedoes at Newport. MacDonald looked at him sharply.
You get around.
Dorothy Langner mentioned Kent and Wheeler. I gathered they were Langner counterparts.
Counterparts? MacDonald laughed. That's the joke of the dreadnought race, don't you see?
No, I don't. What do you mean?
It's like a shell game, with a pea under every shell and every pea packed with dynamite. Farley Kent devises watertight compartments to protect his hulls from torpedoes. But up in Newport, Ron Wheeler improves torpedoes, builds a longer-range torpedo that carries heavier explosives, maybe even figures out how to arm it with TNT. So Artie had to increase gun range so the ship can fight farther off, and Chad Gordon had to cast stronger armor to take the hits.
Enough to drive a man to drink. MacDonald refilled their glasses.
God knows how we'll get along without those lads.
But speed, you say, is also vital. What about you in steam engineering? Bell asked. They say you're a wizard with turbines. Wouldn't Alistair MacDonald's loss be as devastating to the dreadnought program? MacDonald laughed.
I'm indestructible.
Another fistfight broke out across the dance hall.
Excuse me, Isaac, said MacDonald, and he waded cheerfully into it.
Bell shouldered after him. The flashily dressed gangsters he'd seen when he came in were hovering around the impromptu ring of cheering men. MacDonald was trading punches with a young heavyweight who had the arms of a blacksmith and admirable footwork. The Scotsman appeared slower than the younger man, but Bell saw that Alistair MacDonald was allowing his opponent to land punches as a way of gauging what he had. So subtle was he that none of the blows scored any damage. Suddenly, Alistair seemed to have learned all he needed to. Suddenly, he was fast and deadly, throwing combinations. Bell had to admit they outclassed the best he had thrown when he boxed for Yale, and he recalled with a grateful smile Joe Van Dorn steering him into graduate study in Chicago's saloons. The blacksmith was weaving. MacDonald finished him off with an uppercut that was no harder than it had to be to do the job, then helped him to his feet, slapped his back, and bellowed for all to hear,
"You did good, laddie. I just got lucky. Isaac, did you note this fellow's footwork? Don't you think he's got a future in the ring?"
He'd have floored Gentleman Jim Corbett in his prime. The blacksmith accepted the compliment with a glassy-eyed grin. MacDonald, whose own eyes were still restlessly scanning the crowd, noticed the gangsters coming purposefully his way.
Oh, here's another contender. Two more. No rest for the weary. All right, lads. You're runts, but there's two of you. Come and get it.
They weren't quite runts, although MacDonald outweighed them handily, but they moved with assurance and held their hands well. And when they attacked, it was clearly not the first time they had teamed up. Talented street fighters, Bell assessed them, tough slum kids who had fought their way into the upper ranks of a gang, full-fledged gangsters now, out for a night of mayhem. Bell moved closer in case things got out of hand. Hurling filthy curses at Alistair MacDonald, they attacked him simultaneously from both sides. There was a viciousness to the concerted assault that seemed to anger the Scotsman. Face flushed, he feinted a retreat, which drew them forward into a powerful left jab and a devastating right. One gangster staggered backward, blood spurting from his nose. The other crumpled up, holding his ear. Bell saw steel flash behind Alistair MacDonald.